The Habitat Committee met on February the 4th. It was the first meeting that's geared specifically toward Phase 2. So much of what we did was transitional in nature, moving toward from cleaning up some items left from Phase 1 that needed to be straightened out and developing an agenda for Phase 2 and a direction that we're going to take. Behind, the tabs are tab 2, which is, not tab 2, but rather enclosure 2, which is the risk analysis for risk to habitat using the more than minimal and not temporary, the MMNT standard. Number 3 is the timeline that exists now for Phase 2. Number 4 is a White Hake proposed action that I'll get to in a minute. Number 5 is the deep-sea coral provisions in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is something we're going to have to be looking at. And number 6 is the report on the meeting that this report will be generated from. The first problem that we dealt with was a problem that emerged in the White Hake EFH, or HAPC designation, or EFH designation, rather. The adult White Hake designation turned out to be incorrect and needed to be straightened out. So what happened was it came to light that one of the references used by the PDT in setting that White Hake EFH contained an error. It was rather a large error as well, and the error caused the EFH to be designated for the canyons in deeper water down to 2,250 meters than it would have been in the absence of the error. So that had to be straightened out first of all, and the PDT recommendation was to change the depth range for adult white hake from the 2,250 meter to 1,000 meters. The committee considered that and looked at the data that was available. It was level 1 and level 2 data out there and found that there was no record of white hake even at that depth, that the deepest record of white hake was at 831 meters. So proposal was put forward to redefine the deepest portion of white hake EFH to 850 meters. So what I'd like to do is, first of all, to put up the first committee motion just to get that little thing cleared up. Okay, in addition to the problem with the depth, there was also a disconnect between the level 1 and level 2 data on the temperature range available to for the EFH. So what was proposed was to redefine the minimum and maximum depths for adult white hake EFH as 25 meter and 850 meters respectively, and to redefine the temperature range for adult white hake EFH as 2 to 13 degrees Celsius respectively. Again, this was to clean up errors in the Phase 1 designation. And as you'll see, this led to some problems in the canyons that we'll get to as the next item.
Committee motion. Discussion on the committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Ron?
Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. The shallow end, the 25 meters, I had asked if, in fact, we have extensive surveys in Massachusetts waters and Maine waters where that data could be analyzed other than just presence-absence. So, in other words, I think 25 meters is just way too shallow for white hake. It's just not correct, and I think that the state survey data could be looked at closer to determine where the adult white hake are in the shallow end of the range, or else we're going to be probably, again, misidentifying the EFH. I brought it up at the meeting, And all the response was, yes, they're caught in the inshore survey. But, you know, the inshore surveys, a lot of those stations are a lot deeper than 25 meters. The question is if 100 adult white hake are caught and only one is at 25 meters and all the rest are caught at 75 meters, it would imply that 25 meters is the wrong depth.
Anyone else? Drew?
Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. Also, I just wanted to bring up how come we're changing the white hake EFH definition to the 850 meters, and I think people need to be aware of the data that is behind this, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, but this is data that was from, because the trawl survey, the NIMS trawl survey does only goes to a certain depth, doesn't go to this depth, so this isn't based on actual observed white hake at this depth within U.S. waters. It's actually from white hake that were caught in Canadian waters at this depth, and so it's being applied by analogy. So this isn't level two information. This is level one information, and it's by analogy. There is actually no observation within the United States of white hake in these specific areas. Is that correct, Chad?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Dave?
Yeah, thank you. That issue was discussed at length. The PDT recommendation was to 1,000 meters, and after a great deal of discussion, it was decided that since there were observations, level one observations, to 800, I think it was 821 meters, that that we would kind of allow that to be 850. The PDT recommendation was for 1,000 meters, and the PDT was later polled and said that 850 would be suitable for that number.
Anyone else in the council? Rodney.
Yeah, it sounds like they're just picking a number out of the hat. They really don't know what's happening out there.
Anyone else? Jim?
Yeah, just to be clear, I have a problem with picking numbers that way, and I don't believe there's any white hake in 25 adult white hake to amount to anything in 25 meters, and I bet there isn't any adult hake to amount to anything in 850 meters. It doesn't mean one or two might show up there someday, but I think we're really stretching it here. I think we need to think carefully before we continue down this road.
Sally?
My understanding is that this would be a refinement, in fact, of what the existing EFH designation is. Is that correct?
Dave. Yes, that is correct. The existing EFH designation is far deeper, far deeper.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, just further comment, you know, it seemed like there was some discussion about the relative value of data that all of the EFH designations are based on. And I think it needs to be clear that for most of the species, including species like cod, that we just don't have the level of data that we might like to have, but it just doesn't exist, even for a species that's been looked at, you know, from almost every angle possible, like cod. So, you know, when you're talking about level one data, where you're just looking at the presence of a species, or level two data, where it's presence or absence of a species, or the higher level data, which is obviously preferred, you know, oftentimes we don't have that information. That doesn't mean that we can't act. And I think what it seems like what the committee was trying to do was refine one designation where it became clear that there was an ability to do so. And that's what this whole exercise has been about in the first place, is to make more refined designations based on the best information available. So I support this motion.
Dave Gaethel?
Yes, I call the council's to look at document number four here, which is the document that we had to work from at the Habitat Committee. And what you actually had was a disconnect between the text description and the pictorial description. and that was referred to the PDT, and you can see the discussion here about basically trying to draw them into being the same. Like a lot of people, I'm troubled by the shore water side, 25 meters. I've never seen an adult whitehake in 25 meters, and I have fished here. But apparently there is information that they do exist there that calls into account this whole idea of essential and how essential is it if one of them lives there. On the other side on the deep end, things get a lot more complicated because in the United States we don't survey much below 350 meters, so we really don't have any U.S. information there. The only information that was available was Canadian information with individuals down to 820 meters. So there's no reason not to suppose that they wouldn't extend that deep here as well. But it is an inference. The practical matter is that the deep side doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference because we're not fishing there anyway. But on the shore water side, it does potentially make some kind of a difference. And the committee did really spend a lot of time batting this back and forth. And the position that is arrived at is basically a compromise position. I wouldn't say it's based hard and fast on science.
Rodney?
It depends what depth the wreck is at. That's where those fish are. They're wreck predators. They're around the wrecks. That's where the majority of they're caught. So whatever depth the wreck is in, that's where you're going to catch them.
Anyone else on the council? Audience? Maggie?
Maggie Riemann, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I'd also like to speak to the quality of the information that this is based on. The original description said that it was at 2,250 meters, and luckily somebody checked that, and that was found to be incorrect. The PDT then, as has been pointed out, said that there had been some observations at 821 in Canadian waters, and the PDT rounded that to 1,000. That's kind of interesting rounding. But again, I just wanted to say that this particular information is particularly poor. Thank you.
Chad?
Just wanted to point out the PDT did not do the creative rounding. That was actually a cited paper that goes down to 1,000. The PDT supposed that 1,000 might have been a rounding from the 821 observation, but it's not the PDT that did the rounding. It was the published paper. And we don't know for a fact that the published paper did the rounding. It was a presupposition that has, I don't know, seemed to become a legend.
Paul Howard? No, you're all set. Anyone else on the council? I have a question. Document number 4 sort of walks us through how we arrived at the motion that we arrived at on the board. It says that, I guess, Dr. Heydrich is the author of a paper that was cited as referencing the depth ranges. And I read the quote. I assume it's verbatim, and the quote seems to undermine the report that's the basis of the range, unless I'm reading something wrong. Maybe some clarification. Did the committee discuss that? Or
yeah, the original designation for the deepest range of the adult white hake was based upon a paper that has since disappeared that was done by Dr. Heydrich. And when he was contacted to verify that, because it was different from any of the other data that was available, even the Canadian data, which only went down to 821 meters. When he was contacted, his response was, well, no, that can't be right. He said it was a paper that was fairly old, and he didn't remember the exact numbers. He went to try to dig up the paper and couldn't find it. So we have, in fact, no data that indicates that hake are found down below 1,000 meters. not from Canada or not from the United States. So that original designation of, 2250, is certainly incorrect. So the attempt by the committee was to correct that to the extent that we can using the same type of criteria that has been used in setting all of the other EFHs, rather. And that was the supposition upon which the PDT was acting. So the PDT used a paper published that said that the range was to 1,000 meters, which is on a lot firmer basis to the extent that any of these are. And that was the reason why they changed it to 1,000. But the original paper by Dr. Heydrich, he didn't even remember the where it came from. And the paper had disappeared.
Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So, okay, so we have published papers for the 1,000, so that wasn't picked out of the hat. What about the 25 meters, Chad? What was the PDT rationale for the lower end?
The discrepancy was between the text description and the maps. The PDT essentially defined essential fish habitat for adult white hake prior to the council's final decision on the methods to be used for defining adult white hake by map on the inshore. They used the level 2 data to drive the text description, which had a 100-meter minimum depth. And also the temperature range that's in the memo. Then they used the level 1 data from the Elmer and the inshore surveys to do the inshore designation for adult white hake. There was a mismatch when you look at the map based on the level 1 data for the inshore. Great swaths of real estate that is well shallower, well shoaler than 100 meters were designated as EFH. That needed to be cleared up one way or another, either we stick with the 100 meters and do away with the Elmer and inshore survey data that drives us to one conclusion, or we incorporate in the text description the conclusion that we reached based on the methods used for the inshore designations. And those methods were used across the board. We're not doing anything with adult white hake that's inconsistent with what was done and what the council decided to do with every other species in life stage.
What else in the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Three opposed. Motion carries 13-3. Dave?
Okay, we, true to the law of unintended consequences and cascading events, what happened was that as soon as white hake was changed to 1,000 meters, that left us hanging out on the canyon, HAPCs. So many of these were non-conforming, including 8 Hydrographer, Veatch, Alvin and Atlantis Canyons, Hudson Canyon, Wilmington Canyon, Oceanographer, Gilbert and Ladonia Canyons, Toms, Hendrickson's, and the Intercanyon areas all now became non-conforming. So that's the next thing we have to do is to straighten that out. And I'm going to turn this over to Chad so he can show you the extent of the problem.
Okay, I'm going to go off of the presentation handout that was just passed out. Basically, the problem is that to be an HAPC, you've got to be designated EFH for some species in some life stage. And even prior to, well, the discovery or the problem with white hake was based on evaluating the existing canyon HAPCs under existing EFH. And when the PDT had a conference call on this issue, because there were 3 canyon areas that were non-conforming based on the adult white hake going down to 2,250 meters, one of our astute PDT members said, well, first of all, I think we need to look at the white hake issue. And then we backed up and addressed the white hake issue. So I'm going to go to the 2 slide. Yeah, that's the right slide. There we go. On the EFH that's currently on the books, absent the last motion, we had these 3 areas where there was areas within the HAPC boundaries that were not designated EFH for any species. So those 3 would have needed to be either redrawn or had a text description accompanying them that kind of exempted them from the actual boundaries. Right now, the HAPCs are defined spatially. They're defined on those boundaries. So we want to make sure, it's important to make sure that the boundaries include EFH for some species. Post-motion, now we're down to 850 meters for adult white hake, and then we have to look at the next deepest off-shelf designation for EFH, and in this case, it's juvenile and adult witch flounder, and they go down to 1,500 meters. So now we've got a number of different canyons that have HAPCs where there's not EFH designated, based on, again, based on that last motion. So the last slide was a picture of the northern, this is the Mid-Atlantic canyons, and the red areas are currently designated HAPC, but the areas that lie outside of designated EFH. And then we can go kind of slide by slide through Hydrographer Canyon. It's just that one little southeastern sliver. We can go to the next one, which is Veatch Canyon, and the next one. And you can kind of see the trend here. Hudson Canyon. There's some of the next few might get a little bit more interesting. Not interesting yet, just a typical. Okay, this one's interesting where we've got a hole, a little bit of a deep water spot in the middle of the HAPC. That area right there that is kind of the artifact looks like it cannot be part of an HAPC, so we'd have to have a donut hole. Next slide. Same here. We've got one donut hole above the 1,500-meter curve, and then we've got a seamount, kind of, a very small 1,500-meter spot that's just south that would that falls inside that boundary. And if we were to go with just drawing at the 1,500-meter line for the seaward extension of the HAPC, you'd capture that as well. Next slide. So these are the canyon area HAPCs that are currently or the areas that are currently non-conforming. Next slide. No. Not that slide. That'll confuse things. Yep. Those are the hidden slides. Now, the PDT recommendation to the committee was to simply draw, to do what the committee did, or the council did with the seamount HAPCs, which was to designate HAPCs in the areas that have designated EFH for some species in life stage, basically along the depth contour for that deepest water species, which, like I said, was juvenile and adult witch flounder at 1,500 meters. So those curves, the blue lines that were on the maps, would then become the HAPC boundary as per the PDT's recommendation, and I believe that was the committee's motion as well.
Okay, it's important to recognize that what we're talking about here is still a phase one operation. This is designation. It's not. We're not trying to set up areas that are going to be managed at any time in the very near future. So, as Chad said, in light of an attempt to redesignate these, according to how this has been done before, the committee discussed at great length how to do it. And another complication that came in was the coral issue, which I'll get to later. But first, the best way, bearing in mind that this is still a phase one operation, was to make a revision that would use the depth contours. So I'd like to put up the second committee motion. And that is, the committee motion is to revise the boundaries of the 8 HAPCs affected by the redefinition of white hake EFH maximum depth such that their seaward boundaries follow the 1,500-meter depth contour, comma, the deepest designated EFH for adult and juvenile witch flounder.
Discussion? Any discussion or questions from the council? The audience? Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. Just trying to follow along. Which, the motion two here, which I don't understand which motion. I'll just go right to it. The document, the meeting summary that Chad did, I believe, is excellent. It really captured the discussion at the council committee and from the audience. It was a great job. My concern is that this is supposed to be the science part of the process that we're adjusting here. And what it really boils down to is that the proposers of these HAPCs, the justification was Carl, and HAPC was the only tool available at the time to protect it, so the council legitimately sort of force-fit it. And from day one, I've been against that idea. That's why I proposed the two large boxes, and I said they would, in phase two, they should be called research areas. One of the main reasons is I've done a lot of work out there, and the more valuable complex habitat is not in the canyons. The canyons are soft. That's why they're eroded. It's between the canyons. That's the most productive bottom. It has the most coral, and wherever there's been presence-absence data where toes have been taken outside of the canyons, they've come across loads of coral, and that's where most of the species are. That's probably has the most... that's where the hard rock outcroppings are. So the whole concept of making canyons APCs, I was against from day one. The science just is not there. And I mean, Chad could speak to it, Lou could speak to it, but there's no way anybody that's looked at the information could say that the canyons are more valuable than the between canyon spaces for any of the reasons that one designates an HAPC. So here we are now in phase two, and there is just no reason, no justification for those HAPCs. It just doesn't exist. The only logic is, well, until we have something else on the table, let's leave them in. I just think that's the wrong direction. I think right now you should be honest, take them out, and at the same time instruct your PDT to develop the coral areas, which is in here. But to just leave these in based on science, it's just a lie. It's just not true. It's not supported.
Drew.
Drew Minkiewicz, Fisheries Survival Fund. Just to follow on Ron's comments, if you go back to the beginning of these HAPC proposal for the canyons, they were a result of a public solicitation by the council to outside groups. These were brought forward by various environmental organizations, and in their stated objective, it was to protect deep-sea corals. The entire record on these HAPCs is filled with discussions stating these are to protect deep-sea corals. In the interim from when these were proposed, the Magnuson-Stevens Act was reauthorized, and there's Section 408, which allows the council, once a list that is forthcoming, it isn't out yet, but once there's a list that designates where deep-sea corals exist, the council is allowed to protect those areas under Section 408. What you're doing here is you are designating this area as HAP. If you pass this motion, you are designating these areas as HAPC based upon EFH, that, as we just discussed earlier, is questionable. I mean, it is not. It's level one information. It's not level two. It's not level three. It is at the extreme of any of these species range. You're bringing in juvenile witch flounder at the end of the process here to get you some EFH so you can actually designate it as HAPC. So suddenly, this area at the very extreme range of their observed locations now, habitat area of particular concern, not just essential, but a habitat area of particular concern. Meanwhile, you're doing this all really in the name of deep-sea coral protection when the proper venue for this is Section 408 of the Act. What you are doing is, by definition, arbitrary and capricious. You have one stated objective of protecting coral, and you are using a completely different and questionable grounds of justification to establish these HAPCs. If you do this, it will have a very hard time withstanding judicial scrutiny, because you cannot state one objective. And let's be very clear, throughout this whole process, it's been deep-sea coral, deep-sea coral. That's clear. So if you do this and you do it with these different designations and at the extreme ends of the range and really with no justification of why these particular canyons are habitat areas of particular concern for juvenile witch flounder when you bring it in at the end of the process, and for white hake when you find out that, oh, we didn't even have the boundary correct, you're really on shaky ground here. And I just ask that you consider what you're doing here. I mean, voting for this motion is saying we are going to do this in the name of deep sea coral, even though it isn't the proper venue to do so. Thank you.
To that point, to those points, Drew, is that to say that EFH can't overlap with coral protection areas?
No. No, that is a separate process. Deep sea coral is completely separate. What Section 408 says is the National Marine Fisheries Service, in their process of doing this, is going to create a list or catalog of known observed areas with deep sea corals. From that list of known areas, you can then choose areas to protect for the sake of protecting deep sea coral. That's a separate process, completely separate from the essential fish habitat process, that is now available to this council to achieve this objective. Some of my friends that will follow, I'm sure, after these comments will say, well, this is a good thing that you're doing with HAPCs, and you should do this. And basically their argument is going to be you want a dual track on this. You want to have this in place until we get the deep sea coral protections in place. Am I being consistent by arguing against dual tracking in this instance? Probably not, but then none of us have been on this issue because we're always trying to dual track wherever it serves our interest, to be honest. So you can't justify this going forward as just a dual tracking because you're doing it for a completely separate purpose that is under a separate act, separate section of the act. Thank you.
John Williamson.
John Williamson for Ocean Conservancy. I appreciate Lawyer Minkowitz informing you as to what I'm going to say, so I'm going to try to say something different. But you have done a good thing by designating this an HAPC. The analysis that was done for this HAPC demonstrated that all eight criteria, the four criteria in the law, and the four criteria that this council has used to define HAPC, all eight criteria are met. Extensive analysis, okay, and there's a lot of habitat value in these canyons as defined in this alternative. The fact that there are corals, hard and soft corals, in this area just adds to their value. So I think this council should be proud that you've gone down this route. There are a lot of people in my community who are patting this council on the back for being proactive in this way, and I don't think you should step back from this at this point.
Okay, back to the council. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I'm still struggling with this. That is to understand some of the justification for our getting rid of the straight lines and going to depth contours that create very difficult to find lines. I guess my first question is, the plant development team recommended revising the boundary so that it would follow appropriate depth contours. Does that conflict with the previous plant development team recommendation regarding how the boundary should be drawn, that is, straight as opposed to depth contours? Just seeking a clarification regarding that and to determine whether the plant development team has a different point of view now as opposed to before when we first made that decision to go with the straight lines. So that's the question.
Yeah, to answer that question, the PDT was following the same model as they used with the seamounts. That was their only the only thing that I saw that they had used as a justification for that. I don't think anybody thinks that we're going to take any specific management action based upon depth contours. At this point, it's a designation. We're in the designation phase, and it's not in any way does it conflict with what's been done before or that is being done on the seamounts. As far as the points that were brought up, there isn't anything that Drew or Ron said that is essentially incorrect, but there is a problem with their emphasis. And they're trying to conflate two things here. The what we're trying to protect here is habitat, not specific species, and that's why it's being done in this way. The coral issue I'm going to be bringing up in the next motion. That is clearly what we're trying to protect out there is coral, but it's habitat that we're protecting. And at this point, the only and I admit that it's not perfect. It's probably not even the best way to do it, but the only way we can do it is by designating these canyon areas as HAPCs. And Ron is exactly correct about the corals being even more important in the intercanyon areas. But we do not have a mechanism at this time to protect that. So the idea was to protect what we can with what we have available. The coral issue is important, and I will speak to that, and I have a motion on that subsequent to this. But at this point, right now, what we have to do is to designate these HAPCs as habitat areas of particular concern, not the biota, but the habitat itself, and to follow the same kind of criteria that was used before. I think it's very likely that we're going to have a coral action out there, but I cannot predict that right now because that is in its very beginning stages. And as I said, I will speak to that afterwards. Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, did the plan development team change its mind? Now, you didn't answer my question, I don't think. Straight lines versus step contours.
Well, straight lines are preferable, of course.
Okay, fine enough. So we're working with straight lines now, or at least that's what we have proposed. If we go with this particular motion and approve it, would we be removing from the proposed HAPC those areas where corals would be found? Because that was my intent, of course, when I supported the initial designations, the initial proposals, that indeed, appropriately so, we should incorporate those areas where corals would be found. That influenced my vote. So if we're now going to remove area where corals would be found, I would not want to support the motion.
That's a good point. I didn't realize that was what you were getting at. I would say that we probably would be. I'm not going to hedge that one. We probably would be. I'd turn that over to Chad, though, to comment.
The mind reels. To the initial question of whether the PDT changed its advice, the answer is probably yes. Initially, before the Madison Act was reauthorized, there was no mechanism for protecting deep-sea coral specifically. And so the thinking on the HAPCs was that they might be the basis for some management action in the future. Plain and simple, that was, I think, what people had in mind. So straight lines made a little bit of sense to allow the council to take action in the future on management action if the council so chose. The Madison Act now has deep-sea coral provisions that allow the council to take alternative measures that are completely unrelated to EFH or HAPCs. HAPCs highlight areas that are important, and that's about it. They have to be EFH for some species. They have to meet the other four criteria that are laid out in the EFH final rule, and they have been judged to do so. So the PDT wanted to make sure that they maintained as much of the area that the council decided was worthy of the HAPC designation as possible. And if you were to draw straight lines, for example, north or shoreward of the areas that get a bit squiggly, you would potentially lose some areas that the council had intended to designate and meet the minimum criteria for an HAPC. And they felt that the best way to kind of protect is the wrong word, we're not really protecting anything, to highlight the importance of these areas was to follow that depth contour and capture as much of the area that the council had intended to capture as possible. The second question was, do these areas capture corals? Well, yes, they do, but they probably don't capture all the corals, or if you were to do some sort of a statistical analysis and try to draw boxes of a certain size that would capture the most corals, they would probably not be in the areas where these HAPCs are. And so if you look at the boxes themselves, you'll see lots of corals inside them. But if you look at the corals themselves, you'll see lots of corals outside the HAPC boundaries as well.
Dave Gaith.
Yeah, to David Pierce's point, The law specifies that we can't have an HAPC that isn't a subset of some EFH. As long as White Hake went to 2,250 meters, you could have square boxes or rectangular, whatever you want to call them, because all the bottom was shoal in 2,250. Absent White Hake going to that depth, the next deepest species is witch flounder, which goes to 1,500 meters. Therefore, in order to comply with the law, we now have to have squiggly lines instead of square boxes, because all the area outside the squiggly lines is deeper than 1,500 meters. So we can't really have the square boxes anymore, even if you wanted to have them, because it would not comply with the law as written. So we basically have no choice at this time but to do things the way it's envisioned on the screen.
Another question. It's been referenced, this section 408. When do we expect to get? We're waiting for guidance, like we are for Standard 1 and other things, or I'm just trying to understand this process that's going on now that the law has been amended.
Yeah, I don't know that we're waiting for a whole lot of guidance. I have a motion to on corals that will be subsequent to this one, along with justification from Magnuson for it. And we are going to move in that direction as expeditiously as we can. The idea was that in the meantime, while that is in action, that we do the very most that we can. And this is the most that we can. That was the reason for it.
I guess one of the comments that came out of the audience was that, and maybe I heard it wrong, there's going to be a list populated. Is that some list of corals? Is it going to list the actual corals that we know about, or the locations of the corals, or both?
Well, that is addressed in the next motion. Yeah, basically, we're going to have to do that.
Okay. We don't. That's a function of the council.
Well, the PDT has to look at it. I don't know yet.
Okay.
How that's going to wind up. The PDT. We are charging the PDT to initiate that process.
Chad.
So we're clear on the kind of nomenclature. Section 408 of the Magnuson Act requires the service to produce a report to Congress on known deep sea coral locations. That report is in its final stages. It should be published and sent to Congress, if it's not been already, very soon. It was reviewed by the PDT. The PDT felt that it highlighted areas that were sufficient to allow the council to take action on deep sea coral protection in the future and didn't really restrict anything that the council is going to be able to do. It's Section 302 of the Magnuson Act that allows the council to take action on protecting deep sea corals. It says that the council can, based on the corals that were identified in Section 408, choose to limit fishing activities to protect deep sea corals if it wants to.
Jim Odom.
Yeah, I have a problem with this motion. I just can't get my arms around that we're redefining the White Hake EFH past the depth that any piece of paper that has them on is 821 meters, down to 1,500 meters, because of the presence of adult juvenile winter flounder, witch flounder. It must be something in my makeup or something, but I can't see how we can justify going to 1,500 meters when the wildest paper you have is 841 meters. And you're using the justification that there's adult juvenile witch flounder in there to designate White Hake EFH. I can't get my arms around that.
Dave Preble?
Oh, no, what it says is that it's affected by the redefinition. Because of the redefinition, it doesn't say that we're going to now designate it as White Hake EFH. What we're doing is we're changing it to witch flounder, juvenile witch flounder. But the important thing to bear in mind is that what we're trying to do here is to protect habitat. That's what Magnuson allows us to do, in fact requires us to do. And we can't protect it without having some designated EFH for that area. It's not what we would prefer to do, but it's the only thing we can do right now to protect coral, or coral habitat is what it boils down to. And as far as the coral thing is concerned, I was going to hold this off until the coral. In fact, I'm going to hold it off. That's enough.
Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was involved in this on the committee, so I have perhaps a little bit of an advantage of see how we got in such a confused state from where we started. But briefly, HAPCs were requested and proposed, and they were in boxes that people thought contained some particular habitat that they thought was valuable. The law says that any HAPC has to be EFH for something. And in the beginning, because White Hake was defined as going to 2,500 meters, those boxes all conformed and had some sort of EFH. But that EFH had no relationship to what it is you were trying to protect in that box. And to me, that's sort of a fundamental flaw or a fundamental problem that this council has to address. EFH, the general person, I think, would say, well, if EFH has to be, an HAPC has to have EFH in it that's essential for fish, and that's why you're concerned about this area, that there's some connection between that EFH and the HAPC. But in the law, there isn't. The law says you can have an HAPC. As long as it's habitat for something, you can choose it. This one was chosen for coral, and coral isn't even one of the species that we have EFH for. So, and then when we redefined hake, instead of shallower, that meant that a certain portion of those boxes were just illegal. They were not legally valid HAPCs. So at that point, during the committee, and I had made a motion that these HAPCs should be taken off the table as HAPCs. And the explanation was you shouldn't do that because in the end, it will be clear to everybody that these HAPCs are not really relevant to the best places for coral. They don't have anything to do with hake for real protection of hake or witch flounder, and therefore they will be gone. But at that time, we will have, because of the revisions in the law, we will have a mechanism whereby we can choose the right areas for corals that really should be protected. And so leave it in. It'll be clear to everybody at some point that these HAPCs will go away and we will have the right areas for corals. Personally, I don't like that. I don't think it makes much sense because along the way we get into these kind of arguments. What are we doing here? And then likely, it can engender ideas that, well, the HAPC is there, so we should protect something. And for example, witch flounder goes to 1,500, so let's protect witch flounder and use that. And it doesn't do much for witch flounder. It's kind of the extremes of its range. So I don't like that. But that's what the advice was given to us and the committee acted on, is that leave it in there and then get on with the direct effort to protect corals by looking at coral habitat, and these will fall out along the way. I can understand people's concern. I share it myself. I think that it's going to lead to much confusion both by the public and by the council about what it is this HAP is really for and how can it stay there. The reason I think that this motion is on the floor is that the advice was given is that, you know, you really can't take it out now. It's just going to become clear as we go along that it's not a very useful HAPC designation. And so we got into, well, if you're going to do it, because of the law, you just have to do it where the actual EFH boundaries are. And that, you can't have an HAPC that's bigger than the EFH boundary, so that's why it got reconfigured. I don't know if that's helped anybody or made it totally more confusing, but I think people need to realize that the motives for this HAPC was basically coral. And it does not well do that, although there's definitely some overlapping of coral in there. And now there's a better mechanism to deal with coral, and we should get on with doing that. I encourage us to get on with doing the best we can for the coral air habitat. And we now have a method to do that, and I think we should quickly as possible, recognize that these HAPCs are not for doing much for coral. They can't be in the areas where most of the coral occurs. They don't do anything for white hake. They don't do anything for witch flounder. So, you know, we're just keeping on this sort of figment of our imagination that as long as it's legal, we can do something that will help. And it, to me, it just doesn't help. It makes the whole process more complex, more confusing, and I think it irritates some people and confuses others. Thank you.
I've got at least four or five hands up. Most of the people have not spoken on the issue, but I'll go to the chair if he wants to.
Yeah, just one very quick comment. This motion does not change in any way the original rationale for setting these up as HAPCs. The original rationale was to protect coral habitat, and we were using whatever we had available. So we aren't really changing that at all. All we're doing is responding to the need to move the line inward and still try to capture as much as we can while we analyze and figure out how to move forward with the very, very strong protections for corals which are incorporated in the new reauthorization of the Magnuson Act. We need to move, as Jim said, we need to move very quickly on that, but we have not been able to begin to move that on it yet. That is, as I said, the subject of the next part of this discussion. Thank you.
Mr. Rule and Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question. I guess I'll ask you to chat if you don't mind, sir. And that is simply, do you know the frequency of occurrence of in the southern canyons, basically, let's say, Hudson south of either the white hake or the witch flounder? Do you have any information on that whatsoever?
No, not off the top of my head, no.
Okay, I'd find it very interesting that there was any occurrence at any significant levels at all in those areas, but with my experience. But then again, we don't normally get down to real deep water. And the other is related to this depth contour issue. I mean, all we've ever heard as far as enforcement goes is big square straight line boxes. And you couldn't take in the 850-meter range or 842-meter range, you couldn't set a gill net in 842 fathom. You couldn't tow a trawl net in 842. You couldn't steam 842 fathom. You couldn't row 842 meters in a rowboat. These are not at all straight contours. They're far, far from it. So what's going to happen down the road when these recommendations become potential closures? If you're going to try to have a potential closure based on a depth contour, I'm going to suggest now that it's going to be totally impossible. Totally. I mean, these are very steep edges. And that brings me to my last point about these coral issues. And, you know, we as a monkfish committee were one of the first committees to come out and try to do something to protect cold water corals. Everything that I've read or understood about these corals is they live up, it takes 100 years for them to grow. The bottom line is if it takes 100 years for it to grow, the only way it's got to its age now is we haven't been able to get there to screw it up. So it's simple as that. If we can't tow there, never could tow there with no regulations, then what makes you think we're going to tow there tomorrow or set gear there? I don't think it's accessible areas to the traditional fishing industries. Not that it doesn't need to be designated, but it's self-protected simply because of where it is. That's just my two cents with it. But I am concerned with what the occurrence of these species in the southern canyons would be. That would be interesting to see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Simpson?
Okay, thank you. The reason we got into this was concern that with the redefinition of EFH for white hake, you now have these non-conforming HAPCs. But, I mean, it occurs to me this – we don't have new EFH designations until we pass the omnibus amendment. So until that happens, we still have the protections for coral in these HAPCs. until the omnibus is adopted. We haven't changed the depth definition of white hake. And we now, you know, through the reauthorization, have the ability to designate protections for coral explicitly. We don't have to create this workaround through white hake. So, and as Dave Preble pointed out, the committee does have a motion to do just that, start working in parallel on a coral designation and work up alternatives for protection. So, I mean, if that proceeds, almost if we had taken that one first, we wouldn't need to do this. So, I mean, that's how I'm thinking at it now, and just looking to get a nod that from NIMS that these EFH designations haven't changed yet. They won't change until the omnibus is done. And so this isn't a problem until the omnibus is done, and we've consciously decided not to do anything about corals.
Does the service care to respond to that?
I think we're arguing all the things that we already argued when we passed phase one, and that we're going to re-argue when we get to phase two. This is nothing more than a housekeeping motion. We're spending way too much time on it. You know, you passed a motion that effectively changed the EFH for white hake, and so to fix what is now a disconnect between the HAPCs and EFH, you need to pass this motion. And that's all it does. It's housekeeping.
Sally McGee.
Yeah, just given that we've been having this argument again, my intent when I raised my hand was to engage in the debate again. And it's hard for me to hold back, but I think Pat's comments are really to the point. I mean, we have argued this over and over and over again, and we've debated it in lots of different forums, including the council, the committee, the Habitat Advisory Panel has had a chance to comment on this. The PDT has gone over this. They've reviewed it. They've refined it. They've changed the boundaries according to the best information that they have. And this is housekeeping, and we have done this. And we could go over this one. We could go over the other HAPC designations again. We could drag this out ad nauseum. We could never get to phase two, which is perhaps something that might be preferable in some people's minds, to just keep going over this and over this and over this. But we've done it already, and it is housekeeping, so we should just be done with it.
Yep. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Ten opposed. Five opposed, abstentions. Two abstentions. The motion carries 10-5. Two abstentions. Dave?
Okay, now we can move on to corals. The reauthorization of the Magnuson Act gives us a mechanism, finally, for protecting corals. And I'd like to point out to you just how strong that is. In 109-479, Magnuson says that we can designate zones where and periods when fishing shall be limited or shall not be permitted or shall be permitted only by specific types of fishing vessels or with specific types and quantities of fishing gear. Paragraph B that immediately follows that says that we will designate such zones in areas where deep sea corals are identified under Section 408 to protect deep sea corals from physical damage from fishing gear or to prevent loss or damage to such fishing gear from interactions with deep sea corals. Now, the reason I point that out is because when we designate for corals, it's not going to be EFH or HAPC. It doesn't stem from the same legislative initiative. What it does is it has its own separate designation. So what we are going to try to do here is to move as quickly as possible on that so that we can clean up this housekeeping issue that we keep going over. With that in mind, I have a third committee motion, which is, there it is, to direct the Habitat MPA Ecosystem PDT to evaluate existing information on deep-sea corals and to develop management options to protect deep-sea coral habitat. It is understood that these options
would be independent of any EFH and HAPC designations. So in other words, what we're doing is moving into uncharted territory.
Discussion on the motion. Paul Howard.
Did the I think we've been all, you know, waiting for this habitat amendment to get done. And, you know, was there any talk about how this might interfere with getting the habitat amendment done? And there's an awful lot of, you could spend the same amount of time protecting coral as we're trying to do with habitat. So I'm just concerned that we prioritize what we're doing and get it done before we tackle new things.
Yeah, we didn't directly discuss that because the first thing we want to do is to get some basic information from the PDT about just what it is we have to do. We don't have that in hand yet, so that discussion, we kind of put that off maybe until the next meeting to see what we're going to do with it.
The other thing to keep in mind is we want to get this done so that species other than scallops might want to do the same thing that we just allowed scallops to do. Do their own individual habitat protection, and then all this work would be a nod if we now say everything's going to go back to the species committee. We'll have Chad work with the species committee. So we got to get this done.
Dr. Pierce,
just a couple of questions. The motion indicates that the habitat plan development team will evaluate existing information on deep sea corals. To what extent has that been done already? I thought that that was one of the major initiatives. The Habitat Plan Development Team, to what extent have they already evaluated existing information on deep-sea corals? It's a tough task, I know, but my understanding is that they did what they possibly could do last time around. So if the job is already done, then, okay, we don't need it in the motion. But if it needs to be done, fine enough. That's my first question. The second one is, you know, protection of deep-sea corals is a priority of mine. How long might it take before we end up with something that we could consider for implementation? 5 years? 6 years? At least with the HAPC designation that now we no longer will have, that will protect some deep-sea corals in those areas where they will be found. At least we would have had something in place to protect deep-sea corals using that strategy. Now I don't see that happening. So this becomes even more important to deal with protection of deep-sea coral habitats. So the second question is, what's the timeline? Do we have any estimates of how long it will take to get this job done? So the first question was, has the Habitat Plan Development Team covered this, have done this evaluation already?
Yeah, the PDT question, I'd refer to Chad. He knows more about that than I do.
The PDT has not previously evaluated protecting deep-sea coral holistically. There are members of the PDT that are, I would probably say, worldwide recognized experts on cold water deep-sea corals. And so they individually have done a tremendous amount of work on deep-sea corals and documenting the presence, et cetera, et cetera. But the PDT was never tasked with evaluating protecting deep-sea corals. The advice that the PDT has provided in the past showed basically existing boundaries or proposed boundaries for HAPCs and documented the known corals that may lie inside those boundaries. That analysis, I think, completely excludes the known corals that lie outside those boundaries. And at least from the PDT chair's perspective, that's what I think that this motion is kind of tasking the PDT with looking at. As for when we can expect to get some results from this, the PDT told the committee that we were comfortable incorporating deep-sea coral protection or deep-sea coral vulnerability as one portion of the risk assessment that the PDT is going to be doing, and that we did not think that incorporating that would delay the timeline at all. So from the PDT's work perspective, which is a little bit different from the Council's decision-making perspective, we don't believe that this will delay the timeline for the omnibus amendment.
I'd just like to make one brief comment. I think Paul's question brings up the issue of why I think this was not just a housekeeping measure. And that is, if we don't go on and look directly at corals and try to do something specifically about that as an additional task, then we're going to be falling back to the fact everybody here so far has been talking about protecting corals. A HAPC designation doesn't protect anything. It sets up an area where you look at it. So what we will do is, as this progresses and we don't do anything with the corals directly, we're going to start, well, all we've got is this HAPC, and, well, we better do something to protect corals in the HAPC, and, well, we now what are we going to do to protect them? And it becomes a big issue. It will become a big issue, because once you start getting into what are you going to do about it, it becomes a big issue. And so this idea is to say, well, if you're going to protect corals, let's go directly to corals. Let's figure it out and do it. Or we're going to go back and do it through the HAPC process that we already have seen isn't really well suited to it and doesn't really allow us to get to the point. And that's going to make those battles even more difficult for us. So I think that, you know, I appreciate the idea that it could be and probably should be a housekeeping measure, but I don't think it's going to be. So we better figure out which direction we're going to pursue and pursue it. Thank you.
A question for Chad. Chad, on the your last statement about the amount of work for the PDT, so you're saying that without adjusting the timeline, you could incorporate designating coral protection areas and also developing alternatives for the committee to vote on to protect those canyon areas as part of this amendment, including in this amendment, not outside of it. So we'd include that action in the Omnibus Habitat Amendment without any delay in implementation.
That's right. Very briefly, what the PDT intends to provide the committee is, to the best of our knowledge, doing as thorough a job as we can, recommendations on which areas might be most vulnerable to fishing gears, using the more than minimal, not temporary nature standard, and definitions of adverse that the PDT has yet to propose options for to the committee. So incorporating corals into that assessment won't be a tremendous amount of additional heavy lifting. Analyzing more alternatives and presenting more alternatives to the committee and to the council will certainly take a bit more time, but we don't think that it will delay, from the workload perspective, it shouldn't delay the amendment at all.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Drew, then Bonnie. How come you guys can't sit up front?
It's more dramatic when you walk up like this. Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. If you're going to, because I originally was going to ask what the intent of this motion was to include this procedure within the existing EFH Omnibus Habitat Amendment, and it, as the motion is currently written, states that it's going to be independent of any EFH or HAPC designations. So you have a document that's been developed over the last 3-4 years that went out for scoping and was completely talked about EFH and HAP designations, and now in the middle of it you're going to drop in deep sea coral protections that are under a completely different section of the Act, different justifications. How is this within scope of the original document, and how can you just airdrop this in the middle of the process?
Good question. Chad?
Sure, I'll take a shot. The Act requires councils to designate EFH, HAPCs as appropriate, and to protect habitats from the adverse impacts of fishing to the extent practicable. Clearly, that was part of the scoping for the Omnibus Amendment, and clearly protecting corals from the adverse impacts of fishing to the extent practicable is well within that scoping, at least from my perspective.
Well, it's a good try, I'll give you that. But when you're explicitly stating that you don't has nothing to do with essential fish habitat or HAPC designations, then I would argue you're out of that scope, because that's the whole document, is the Omnibus Essential Fish Habitat Amendment.
Chad?
Again, the final rule says specifically that areas that the council can consider for protection of EFH, can consider for protection from the adverse impacts of fishing to the extent practicable may lie outside of areas designated EFH. So I don't really see a conflict there.
Kedra?
Well, I guess we'll agree to disagree at this time, but it's a question you should ponder when considering this motion.
I take it you're arguing for an entirely new process that's separate from the omnibus amendment.
I think that would be appropriate. I mean, you are in the middle of a 3-4 year process here and airdropping in something completely different.
Okay. All right, Bonnie?
Bonnie Spinizzola, Atlantic Offshore Lobstermen's Association. You know, I haven't been to this process in a long time, but what I'm doing is I'm coming here and I'm seeing that they're initially, the last committee meeting I came to was when they decided to put the whole HAPCs together. And the purpose for doing that was to protect coral. And I specifically asked the council, what is this EFH protection? And David actually answered me and said coral. So now I'm sitting here and I'm looking at a new process that's going to go in to protect coral. And what it looks like to me is that what's happened to the areas that were originally chosen to protect coral, things are being pulled out of the sky to say, well, it's already there. We've called it EFH. We have to call it EFH for something because we actually figured out that that's not really the areas that we wanted to protect for what we wanted to protect in the first place. And it's a very confusing situation. I think that the council is kind of on the edge here because, as I said, you're pulling things out of the sky to consider what this EFH is for. And so you've developed all of these boxes, and frankly, I don't know if you're going to consider lobster gear as something that is harmful or anything else, but I'm looking at the entire boxes that are strewn across all of the canyons where many people make their living and feed their families and this sort of thing. And when I hear these things being pulled out of the sky to say, well, we've got to figure out, you know, it's flounder. Well, you know, we're a little bit deeper, so let's throw some witch flounder in there. Or let's get some, you know, we've got the white hake, but now we have another area. We've got to figure out EFH for something. And, oh, by the way, we don't have the coral protected. It just, you know, I'm sitting here, and it's blowing my mind. It's throwing me in 15 different directions as to how you can move forward with something like this. And I'm looking back at Jim Salisbury's motion to that the 12 HAPC boundaries in the canyon areas be eliminated from the EFH omnibus amendment. I know you don't want to do that. I understand this. However, if you want to protect the coral, move forward to protect the coral. Don't leave things in there just because. Move forward and do something that you need to do the right thing. Thank you.
Ms. Monica Gibb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We support this motion and believe that something that should be added in that isn't reflected in this motion that was discussed among the committee members was moving this process forward in the most expeditious manner possible. I think that it came from a couple of the different council members that separating this from the HAPC process, that this could get done much more quickly than the 2010 endpoint that's currently proposed for the omnibus amendment, and that with the clear information that's out there, just provided by the Fisheries Service, provided a large document that was just published beginning part of this year, supporting the scientific basis of these coral areas, that we should get this done as quickly as possible, move forward, and then we can get on to the real fight with the other HAPC stuff. So I'd just suggest that this motion be amended to add in the quickest way possible. Thanks very much.
Okay, back to the council. John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. A couple of the public comments made me stop and think for a minute about the process. And I guess I'd like to see if we can't get clarification for the record from legal counsel that moving beyond what we were doing for EFH and HAPC at this particular point to deal with corals is a perfectly legitimate approach.
Jane, there's a question on the floor.
Well, I think you can justify. We're in, we haven't done a DEIS on this phase, right? And we're still pre-DEIS. You can make adjustments. You can use all the committee meetings as scoping activities and make adjustments along the way. If you compare the way the council works with what other agencies do, where everything is done in-house, we're still very much in preliminary stages, if you will, even though it's been going on a long time. I recognize that. But in terms of strictly looking at the documents that have been prepared and what is left to do, I think we can shift, and particularly in light of the fact that this provision to allow protection of corals came down in the middle of the process, that we can expand the scope here and just be very upfront about the fact that we're doing that, and the DEIS explain exactly why we're doing it in light of the timing of the amendments to the Madison Act and the fact that these issues have come up at public meetings, which are de facto scoping types of meetings. So, I mean, John worded his question in terms of it's a perfectly legitimate action. I don't think I'm going to go that far, but I think there are ways to explain it and justify it and make it something that can be defensible legally.
Dave Brubb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick clarification seemed to be a little bit of misunderstanding of the last sentence. It is understood that these options would be independent of any EFH and HAPC designations. The reason it was worded that way was to make it plain that we want to move forward quickly and we don't want to bog this down in the phase one process. So it's just to take the wording of the Magnuson Act and make it clear that this was being fast-tracked right into phase two because it does not fall under the EFH and HAPC.
Okay. So everybody's clear. This is part of the forever living omnibus action that we've been working on. Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Sixteen opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Could have had unanimous. But 16-01. Anything further, Dave?
Yeah, one more short item. We are also going to be in the process of doing risk assessments for habitat loss. I wanted to just make plain that the risk assessments that we're doing are assessments of habitat loss. And we had almost an hour discussion of what type and level of risk assessment we want to do. And we have to do it under the standards of what's called the MMNT standards, more than minimal and not temporary effects. And we looked at what has been done in other regions and decided to, and we also spoke with Lou Chiarella and Dr. David Stevenson about what the best policy would be for us to move on this in the most expeditious manner. And the committee, by consensus, recommended that we recommend to the PDT that they embrace a qualitative analysis using numerical matrices backed up by text. And
any comments on that or any thoughts from the council? Okay. I think we're all set. That concludes Habitat?
That concludes Habitat. Thank you.
Okay. Then we'll take lunch recess till 1:30.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The Catalunya Spirit, the situation is stable. She's about, I think, 15 miles southeast of Gloucester right now. The tow is being conducted by the tug Atlantic Salver. They'll probably keep towing her through the night until she gets her propulsion back up. The ship service electrical has been restored, so that's a great sign, and the plant is warming up. She's a steamship, steam turbine ship, so it's a long process to warm that plant up from dead cold. We expect to have propulsion there probably around midnight, they're saying. So it's not over, but so far the news is good. But also, if anybody knows the fishing vessel Green Eyes from down on Long Island, she sank this morning, 10 miles south of Fire Island. Three persons on board. All three were recovered by a helo from the water in their survival suits. They did something really good in this case, which is they called the Coast Guard early, and they were working with us about 2 hours over the course of them taking on water. So the helicopter was nearly on scene when they had to abandon the ship. So only 10 minutes in the water for those guys, it looks like, from the initial reports. Thanks.